side recording.
Yeah, I've got it going. Great, welcome to the seminar on mental health. I'm Andrew Gordon, and this is a good friend of mine, Ian Walker. We're from Oasis Church in Birmingham, and what I'd like us to do just to begin with is, could we just stand? Because I'd like us just to quickly pray, and then we'll get going. Yeah, Father God, Father, thank you for today. Thank you that we can come, and focus on you, that we can come and get refreshed, but we can also come and get stimulated and invigorated. And Father, I pray that during this next hour and a quarter, Father, as we spend time together, that your heart for people who have mental health difficulties and mental health issues, Father, will come to us, Father God, that we will see something of your heart, that we will be able to learn, but we will also be filled with faith. And as we come and we serve people who have these difficulties, we long to show your love and your grace and your forgiveness, acceptance and support. And Father, just help us to speak and help us to listen in the name of Jesus. Amen. I'm just going to hand you over to Ian.
Right, good morning. As Andrew said, my name is Ian Walker. For the last 5 years, I've been a psychiatric nurse working in Birmingham, initially as a staff nurse on an inpatient acute psychiatric ward, and then for the last 4 years as a CPN community psychiatric nurse for a crisis home treatment team, visiting people at home with acute mental health problems, and that's with the Birmingham Mental Health Trust. The aim of my section of the seminar this morning is really to look at what mental illness is and maybe what it isn't, and hopefully go over some definitions of the main mental illnesses just so that we're all aware of those, and also just to highlight how important mental health issues are to us as a society, but more importantly to us as churches and as Christians. So that's where we're going in this first section. So let's jump in. What is mental health? The World Health Organization states that mental health is not just the absence of mental disorder. It is defined as a state of well-being in which every individual realizes his or her own potential, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to her or his community. That's their definition of what mental health is. What is mental illness then? Well, their definition of mental illness are that mental disorders comprise a broad range of problems with different symptoms. However, they are generally characterized by some combination of abnormal thoughts, emotions, behavior, and relationships with others. Examples are schizophrenia, depression, mental retardation, and disorders due to drug use. Most of these disorders can be successfully treated. That's the World Health Organization definitions, if you like. So in that definition of mental illness, they talk about abnormal thoughts, emotions, behaviour and relationships. And so there's this idea within mental illness as an umbrella kind of idea, is about something that deviates from the norm. And to be honest, that can create a lot of arguments and tensions for mental health professionals and even for people who experience mental health problems. Because what is it to have a normal behaviour, and what is it to have abnormal behaviour? And if you're in one culture, you might display a certain behaviour that is acceptable. Then you move into a different culture, display the same behaviour, and that suddenly becomes unacceptable or abnormal. And have you suddenly become mentally ill? And these are some of the tensions that we face maybe with people that we come in contact with, and certainly the mental health services do to a larger, to a greater or lesser extent, particularly in a multicultural environment, in the cities and towns from which many of us come from. However, there are definable mental illnesses as well. So I don't want to start off by pulling the rug under our feet, because there are distinct mental illnesses that we will cover this morning and hopefully explain in broader detail. Just to say, if there are, we're going to give some opportunity at the end for question and answer, If you'd like to throw in a question, we want it to be reasonably interactive, but also we want to try and cover the material. So if that goes on too long, we might just cut you short and ask you to wait until the end, where we'll do some question and answer. So a few brief statistics. 1 in 4 British adults experience at least one diagnosable mental health problem in any one year. And right at this moment, 1 in 6 people, adults in Britain, will experience a diagnosable mental health problem. For children aged between 1 and 15, 1 in 10 of those have a diagnosed mental health problem. So this is not just an adult-related issue. And mental illness has a dramatic effect on the lives of the people who experience mental health problems. Employment, for instance. People who are disabled because of mental health problems have lower employment rates than all other disabled groups. So only 20% of people with mental health problems are in employment at any one stage. And that's not just an inability to work, that's also stigma attached to employers actually taking on people with mental health problems. A survey done by the Disability Rights Commission said that only 37% of employers are willing to take on someone with a mental illness. And that compared to 60% of employers were willing to take on someone with a physical disability. The Social Exclusion Unit suggests that 75% of employers would not consider employing anyone with schizophrenia. 75% would not even consider it. And so these are some of the barriers that people with mental health problems have to experience, not only the difficulties of their illness and their presentation, but also society's barriers. And the Social Exclusion Unit found that 55% of people with mental health problems felt that stigma was a barrier to employment. So that's just one aspect of it. One person told the Mind organisation, they said, on 2 occasions I lied when I applied for jobs. On both these occasions I said that my 2.5 years absence from employment was due to time spent in prison. I was accepted for the first job and shortlisted for the second. Whenever I've been truthful about my psychiatric past, I've never been accepted for a job. So that's a few brief statistics. In the context of this social action conference, what I want to try and do now is ensure that we all understand those with mental health problems come under the banner of the poor. We have this biblical term, don't we, of the poor, but what do we actually mean by the poor? Do we mean just those who are economically disadvantaged to the rest of the society? Or are we trying to say something more than that? Certainly in New Frontiers, we understand the biblical mandate for remembering the poor, caring for the poor. And in many ways, that's why we're here today, I'd imagine, and having a social action conference. But what do we mean by the poor? Deuteronomy 15:11 says, there will always be poor people in the land. Therefore, I command you to be open-handed towards your brothers and toward the poor and needy in your land. You see, in ancient cultures, as with ours today, poor and needy went hand in hand. And very much people with mental health problems are needy, but they're often poor as well, looking at some of the statistics we've just shown in terms of employment. And Jesus' life, in many ways, I believe, demonstrates his definition of the poor. He didn't just mix with the beggars, the lame, the blind, the mute on the street, but he also mixed with tax collectors, revolutionaries, prostitutes, those found in adultery, and even rabbis questioning their faith. In the parable of the sheep and the goats that was made reference to this morning, the king separates those in front of them on the basis of what they did to the least of the brothers of mine. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me. The politicians today call these people the marginalised, the socially excluded, the socially disadvantaged. But Jesus calls them all the poor. I'm quite confident this morning that Jesus is perfectly happy for us to include people with mental health problems under the banner of the poor and the needy, as it says in Deuteronomy. The writer Michael Spencer states, mental illness is an aspect of a post-fall world. There was no mental illness in Eden. There is mental illness now. What has changed? Sin. The virus of self-centered blindness to the truth and glory of God has twisted and broken every aspect of human nature, from the clarity of our mental processes to the biochemical makeup of our brains. Sin has multi-generational effects. It's embedded in every aspect of the social makeup of human communities and relationships. It has altered everything about the world. To go on, Isaiah 58, a very popular passage, and I'm sure we're going to hear this more than once today, says, "Is this not the kind of fasting I've chosen? To loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry, to provide the poor wanderer with shelter, when you see the naked to clothe him and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood?" And I don't know if you have, but if you've spent any time with people with mental health problems, you know that they definitely fall under these categories. You quickly realise that they are oppressed. They are often hungry. They often wander long distances. I've known people that I've nursed who have walked and walked incredible distances with feet that you wouldn't believe and boots that are falling apart. They often need shelter, and they are sometimes naked and need clothing. To have a troubled mind, I think, is probably one of the most distressing things to experience as a human being. And to have a loved one or a family member who has changed dramatically in their personality and behaviour because of mental illness, to the extent where they don't seem like the same person even, is one of the hardest things to have to watch and to deal with. And this is why one of the main reasons why often people with mental health problems are quite isolated, with maybe few friends and a distant family often. Not always, but often. So these are some of the reasons why I believe it's important that we do look out and reach out to those with mental health problems. It's such a big majority, a big minority of our communities, but also I believe there is a clear biblical mandate. Okay, let's go on to some mental illnesses, and the purpose of this is really to look maybe from quite a medical perspective at some of the different mental illnesses that professionals come into contact with and to describe them, and hopefully dispel some of our maybe wrong preconceptions about some of the mental illnesses, what they are and what they aren't. Okay, so if we broadly split mental health problems, mental conditions, into two broad categories, okay? The first is what the doctors called neurosis, and the second is what they called psychosis. The first, neurosis, are really extreme, severe forms of normal emotional experiences like depression and anxiety, panic, things like that. And these days, they're often referred to as common mental health problems. That's what the professionals would describe them as. And then less common is their second area, which is called psychosis or psychotic experiences, which are really about interfering with a person's perception of reality. Their understanding of what is real and what is unreal somehow gets blurred in their understanding. So there are things like hallucinations and delusions, and I'll go on to explain a bit about what those are. So those are the broad two categories that we're going to go into. And then lastly, I'll talk about a third category, which is personality disorder. So the first area, neurosis. Depression is one of the main neuroses. And this isn't just having a bad day or having an off day and not feeling like getting up in the morning. This is something far more and often lasts over a period of time. It's often about waking up early or having difficulty sleeping. It's often about feeling tired and lacking energy, not eating properly and maybe losing weight, crying a lot, finding that you have no pleasure in the things that you normally enjoy, maybe blaming yourself and having unnecessarily guilty thoughts and feelings, maybe being preoccupied by negative things the whole time, having a bleak, pessimistic outlook on the future, and maybe also harming yourself or thinking about suicide. These are the main symptoms or expressions of depression, not necessarily all of them, but at least some of them. And the main form of treatment for people with depression is still antidepressants. If you go to your GP with some of these symptoms, the likelihood is you'll walk out the door with a prescription for antidepressants. Things like Prozac, Seroxat, Sertraline and Cipramil are the common antidepressants. But more and more, there are starting to be more counselling therapies, talking therapies, available even through GP practices. And actually, recent studies have shown that with depression, for mild and moderate forms of depression, regular physical exercise actually can be as good as taking an antidepressant. And so now more and more professionals in the field are looking at someone's health and their diet and certainly their physical exercise and seeing that that is a possible treatment route, maybe instead of antidepressants, that has similar outcomes with maybe less of the complications that treatment and medication can sometimes give. And mild forms of depression can actually go without any treatment and any intervention at all. As they've come, they can just subside again. So that very briefly is depression. It's going to be a bit of a whistle-stop tour. So the next one to talk about is anxiety. Now, we all feel anxiety at one time or another. For the 10 minutes before this morning, I felt a bit of anxiety. If you go into an interview or you have a stressful situation, we all feel anxious, don't we? It's not necessarily a mental health condition. But the difference with people who do have anxiety as a mental health problem is that there'll be very everyday things that cause these feelings of anxiety. It may be literally walking out your front door provokes an intense reaction. Maybe getting on a bus. Maybe going shopping and being around a lot of people can provoke these kind of feelings. And anxiety is really about a fight or flight reflex. I don't know if you remember biology at school, but the physiology, is it when your heart starts to beat faster to pump oxygen around your body, that you breathe faster and deeper to allow the oxygen, you sweat more to prevent overheating, your mouth might feel dry because your digestive system slows down, so blood is deflected to your muscles, and your senses become more heightened and your brain is more alert. And this is part of the fight or flight reflex. You're either going to run down the street or you're going to put up a fight in these anxiety-provoking situations. But as I say, we all feel that at times, or can do. But for those who are experiencing the medical condition anxiety, it's just their very everyday things that will provoke these intense reactions. There can be treatments for these. There are relaxation techniques, breathing techniques, a technique called graded exposure, which professionals sometimes use to gradually expose someone to the thing that produces the anxiety, even gradually being able to get to the shops. So you might go to the end of your road and then that's an achievement for that day. The next week you might go down the road and round the corner and that would be an achievement. And then you go down the road, round the corner and up to the outside of the shop and then come back. And then the next week you do the whole thing and go into the shop, and that's kind of graded exposure. And it helps to enable people to combat some of that anxiety because it's a gradual way, along with some of the other techniques. Medication can be used for anxiety, antidepressants or things like diazepam, which used to be called Valium, and other counselling techniques as well. So that's in a whistle-stop tour, neurosis, which was one side of our things. Yes, or a question?
You've got mania on the sheet.
Yeah.
Is that only under bipolar, and is it neurosis, or is that psychosis?
It's a very good question. I'm just about to come on to that, actually, so hopefully that'll answer your question. Mania or hypomania is part of a group which is mainly under the neurosis category. It's called a mood disorder, as depression is a low mood disorder. So mania and hypomania are a raised mood disorder, sort of the other end of the spectrum to depression. And so hypomania or mania will be characterised by excessive energy as opposed to depression, which is less energy. It may be that people talk faster and more frequently. It may be that they're full of ideas and they have racing thoughts. It may be that they're easily distracted and they move topics from one to another thing. It may be they feel very euphoric and excited most of the time. Their activity and energy levels will be heightened, and they'll often be unusually friendly, even to strangers, and which might be quite out of character. So this is hypomania or mania. Which is the lady has asked a question about bipolar disorder. Bipolar disorder, which used to be called manic depression, people who have this condition can experience the highs and the lows. And the bipolar is the poles, the opposite poles. So one is depression, the other pole is mania. And that's why it's called bipolar, because they can switch and graduate from one pole to the other between depressive episodes and then manic episodes. And that's what bipolar disorder really means.
But someone can have mania without the depression then, constantly.
Can someone have mania without depression? They can do, yeah. It's possible to experience manic episodes, but they wouldn't necessarily be diagnosed with a condition of bipolar disorder or manic depression because they don't have the lows. So it's mainly the highs. And sometimes when someone is very high, when they have this mania, they can start to believe things that aren't true as well. And this is where we start to then look at the psychosis side of things in terms of the hallucinations and delusions. Someone who is very manic and has mania can often have very overinflated ideas about themselves and think called grandiose delusions. And they believe that they're more than they are. So they might believe that they're related to the Queen, that they're actually royalty. They might believe that they are Jesus Christ, sort of incarnated, and these kind of things. And things that again, wouldn't be real, that the idea of reality has now switched and reality and fantasy somehow kind of get blurred. And that's what happens in psychotic experiences as well. So if we can just move to the psychotic experiences, because someone can experience these without having a mood component, so they may not have a raised mood in terms of mania, they can just experience these psychotic experiences. The word psychotic is badly used, it has to be said, in our culture today. Newspapers and TVs use the word psychotic in a very wrong context. Often they have connotations of violence and murder, and there are headlines in the tabloid press about psychotic axe murderers and things like this. Whereas psychotic really doesn't mean that at all. It really means this idea of someone's understanding of reality gets distorted, and so what is real and what is fantasy somehow get blurred, and they're unable to distinguish between what is real and what is fantasy. And this occurs in maybe two ways, the first of which is the hallucinations. And the hallucinations can take on various forms. They might be hearing voices, so the person hears someone speaking, but the person isn't around. They may be in a room on their own and hear these voices. They may experience a smell that no one else can smell. I've nursed people who have had quite strong feelings of a very strong smell in a room, but no one else can hear those. Or maybe it may be a sensation, maybe on the skin, of something sort of crawling on the skin, but there isn't anything there actually producing that sensation. So often the hallucinations are linked to somebody's senses, be that sight or sound or touch. But the messages that those senses are telling the brain aren't accurate in terms of the world around them. So that's hallucinations. The second part is delusions. And this is really holding firmly to a belief that others would disagree with or see as untrue. And this is where we start getting into the what is culturally appropriate. If any of us, if you're charismatic Christians, if any of us went to our doctor and told us that we heard God speaking to us, then they might have some serious questions over us. But if they understood the subculture that we're part of in terms of our churches, that that's a very normal belief system to have, then they would understand that this is not something that is wildly abnormal, as we looked at in the first definition. And so part of the job of the psychiatrist and the nurse is actually to find out that person's cultural understanding, because then they can really make a proper diagnosis or decision on that person and whether it's abnormal. Yeah, question at the back.
Yeah, something that interests me in terms of that is that where do the government fit in, where do mental health services actually fit in to actually understanding somebody's faith in their illness? That seems to be a big issue in this country. I know it's not so much in America, but something very key. It's very difficult to go and see somebody about an issue when it concerns your spiritual well-being as well, because that mental health worker might not necessarily understand your point of view in regards to your faith as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So the question is about going to a mental health worker or seeking help in the context of maybe your faith and how that's exercised and that can produce conflict. And I agree, I think it can produce conflict sometime or misunderstanding certainly with some mental health professionals. But I suppose what they're looking out for are things that are abnormal or out of the context of the culture. And so if we can explain that the churches we come from, this would be the dominant belief and that would be the understanding for that subculture and that group of people, then I think, as I said, professionals are less likely to raise concerns about that. And certainly when we have people from other cultures, then people are very open about spirits, hearing voices and communicating with God and hearing God speak to us. And maybe I think more and more health professionals are starting to understand that. So hopefully that is something that is changing. The mental health professionals understand there are different worldviews, there are different subcultures, there are different ways of looking at the world and belief systems, and that is changing. But that wouldn't be across the board. So I think, but it's understanding the subculture and the dominant belief system really, and then we get to see and have a look maybe whether they are some of these psychotic symptoms or not. So just to give an example, I nursed someone once who did have this experience of a smell in their house, which was a hallucination. It was what they call an olfactory hallucination. It was a sense of smell. And so that was their hallucination. That was their experience. They were going through a psychotic episode at the time. But this lady also believed that actually this smell was emanating from her neighbour, that her neighbour was actually piping through this smell somehow in a malicious way into her flat. And that part of it is the delusional part of that woman's experience. So the hallucination is the smell that wasn't there. But then she attached her understanding of how that smell had got into the flat was delusional in that it was coming from the neighbour. Now, obviously, we checked out that there weren't any pipes coming through the walls and that this definitely wasn't true. And we satisfied ourselves that that wasn't true and that actually this woman was hallucinating with a smell and she was delusional in terms of that this smell was emanating from her neighbour. And obviously, that had started to cause friction between her and the neighbour because she'd actually accused her neighbour of, you know, what are you doing in my flat and what are you piping through and that kind of thing. So just to give you an example, that's an example of where hallucinations and delusions can both be present in somebody. Just to say on this group of illnesses, which cover things like schizophrenia, The Beautiful Mind, the film with Russell Crowe you may have seen, is a pretty good depiction of somebody with its psychotic experiences. As Hollywood goes, it isn't bad. Certainly a lot better than, I don't know if you've seen the movie, Me, Myself and Irene with Jim Carrey. And that's a lot more in terms of someone with this kind of split personality where one moment they're this kind of normal person going about their daily lives and then suddenly a switch is flicked in their head and they're this kind of crazy person in inverted commas. And really schizophrenia and these psychotic experiences aren't really like that. There isn't generally that kind of switch that suddenly they're one thing and suddenly they're the other thing. A lot of these conditions sort of ebb and flow in a person's life, that they'll go through episodes maybe for a few weeks or a month or two or maybe longer where they are experiencing these things, and that will be a very gradual process that those things increase in their experience, and then hopefully with treatment and care then those things again subside and they return generally somebody with these experiences to a very normal standard of functioning and living life really. And so to meet them, you wouldn't know that any of these experiences had been experienced in the past. And these things from very much ebb and flow. And so in our understanding of supporting people with mental health problems, to understand that ebb and flow is often a kind of cyclical pattern where it does ebb and flow and go around in cycles. So the last area I just wanted to touch on really is the conditions around personality disorders. Yeah, sorry, question. Yeah, the question is schizophrenia and psychosis equivalent in terms of terminology? Psychosis is like an umbrella term for some of these things, and schizophrenia would fall under that umbrella, and so it would be one of the psychotic illnesses. That's how they describe them. If someone has one psychotic episode and then doesn't have any more, and probably about 40% of people who experience these things wouldn't have another episode again for the rest of their lives, then they would just be deemed to have a psychotic episode and that is it. But if over the years they've experienced a few of these episodes over time, then the doctors would start to think about a diagnosis of schizophrenia because that's more of an ongoing condition like that. So yeah, does that explain it here? Okay.
What about treatment of psychosis?
The main form of treatment at the moment is medication. In the form of antipsychotic medication, it's called. So there are a lot of old psychotic medications, things like haloperidol, it's called, chlorpromazine. But over the last 10, 20 years, they've developed a lot more newer antipsychotic medications, things like olanzapine and risperidone, they're called. And they're better in many ways in terms of they don't have the difficult side effects that some of the old medications do. They still do come with side effects. Things like weight gain and things like that can be a particular issue when you take these medications. But generally, they're they're a lot cleaner in that sense, if I can explain it like that, than the older medications. There are talking therapies that are starting now to be looked at in terms of these psychotic experiences, and they're showing more results in terms of what they're able to produce, but still the first line and the main treatment would be medication, and certainly mental health services would be offering medication as early as possible. And with someone with these conditions, the earlier you treat, then the better the outcomes in the future. If it goes on untreated and the person carries on with these experiences for too long, then the outcomes start to actually go down. So it's good to sort of get in there early. And there are mental health services that do try and get in there as early as possible to treat these conditions, because the outcomes are a lot better.
Is that even if they've just had one psychotic episode, they would start treatment?
Even just for one episode, they would start treatment. Yeah, that would be the same. If things then stabilise, then that medication will be reduced and then it probably taken off completely after a few months, maybe even up to a year, and then just to see how things go after that. So. Yep.
I want to share with the group a bit about myself. I'm Richard. I'm from Norwich, East Anglia.
Hi, Richard.
In 1973, I had a very bad fatal motorcycle accident. My girlfriend was 8 months pregnant. Overtaken the car, we decided to turn right, wiped us clean out. She was on a life support system for 3 months. Wow. I had to see him turn the life support off. You know, they'd go with a cesarean to try and save a child. Child died. I had to go to the coroner's court, the funeral, everything. And as I used to be a North Circular night rider, a biker, a leather boy, and whatever, all my biker friends turned against me. When I went to the coroner's court, the guy who caused the accident was completely sober. I hadn't been drinking, I'd been using drugs or anything. Who did the coroner believe? Someone who was sober or someone who was in a straitjacket? I was the person in the straitjacket. Mm. They introduced it, put me in a hospital, mental hospital in Hertfordshire, for 4 years.
Wow.
Under a section.
Yeah.
With the Mental Health Act.
Mm-hmm.
My parents had to write to the Home Office to get me discharged. They retired to Norfolk. I got married in Norfolk. I kept getting constant flashbacks of everything.
Mm.
I used to self-harm. I got divorced in Norfolk. Both parents died. I moved away from Norfolk. I was in a relationship in Suffolk. That relationship went wrong over 6 years. I went back to Norwich with over 250 tablets on me for my diabetes, my anxiety, and my depression.
Mm.
Plus a letter to the solicitor in where my parents were buried, expressing my view that I wanted to find my younger brother and say goodbye to my parents that were buried in West Norfolk. I didn't get that far. I collapsed at Notch train station, whatever. And just because they found over 250 tablets on me, they put me in the hospital in Norfolk for assessment. I was in there for 5 days. They filled me up with drugs. I didn't know whether I was coming or going.
Yeah.
They then said, oh, we're discharging you. I said, well, excuse me, to the psychiatrist, when am I going to go? I'm homeless. I didn't want to know. I said, find your own way. For 3 months, I was sleeping underneath a tree in the city of Norwich, going up to the suit run, seeing the Salvation Army. They in turn said, go to a New Frontiers church in Norwich called King's.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went down there. A gentleman who's in one of the seminars today, Toby, one of the elders, they took me to the front of the stage and they prayed for me. That afternoon I went to the homeless mule. There were 75 of us in there, all having a bit of dinner and crepe. After I left there, I was walking on Curtin Wall, and everyone in Norwich was saying good morning to me. Never seen them before. It was weird. I went to the night hostel that afternoon. I presented myself, and I said, I've come to present myself. I'm homeless. I need a room. were. They had 32 beds in that homeless night shelter. I was accepted. That was in 2004.
Mm.
2004, I was in there for a year and a half, then I moved to one of their group homes, one of St Martin's Trust's group homes. Every Sunday, I kept going to King's, getting more and more involved with it. And from 2004 to now, I haven't self-harmed myself.
Great.
God's got a hold of me.
Mm.
Big time. I'm now part of the small groups. I'm now feeding the King's Care people that come through the homeless meal on
great.
A Sunday.
Yeah.
Well, feeding my old sort. And they say, well, Richard, what's changed about it? I say, well, still the same colour. Yeah. The only thing that's got a hold of me is God.
Yeah.
And that is so truth. When people don't understand depression, realization, or anything,
yeah.
I've been there.
Yeah.
I've got the shirt. God's got hold of me big time.
Yeah.
And coming to this today, seeing everyone in here have respect, it doesn't cost anything. But once you're labelled with mental health,
yeah.
I've now got a permanent tenancy in my flat in Norwich.
Yeah, great.
I've now got the powers to vote. I could actually, they could say, you're right, okay, Richard, you could go to jury service.
Yeah.
But I'm a citizen.
Yeah.
And God's got hold of me. And it means so much.
Amen.
And everyone that sees a homeless person, they either think, oh, he's got drug issues. I don't.
Yeah.
They either got drink problems. I don't drink. I'm a diabetic. Mine is mental anxiety, depression, self-harm.
Great.
My
thanks,
arms
Richard.
Scarred. Literally torn to shreds.
Are we allowed to give you a round of applause? That's fantastic.
For people on the other side of the fence that don't realise how strong God can be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And God and everyone in King's Church in Norwich, the way they have all helped me.
Yeah, fantastic.
My hand is saying, God, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm living proof. Yeah. After going through a lot of sexual abuse in my younger days at school, back in the 60s and 70s, I didn't have anyone to turn to. That's why I self-harm.
Yeah.
I've done 25 overdoses.
Yeah.
I'm a survivor.
Yeah.
Today's kids can go and get help for sexual abuse.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, I didn't.
And this is what we're hoping to get over in the seminar today, is actually the church has a massive role to play.
Yeah, and the only psalm that I can relate to is Psalm 91. Every morning I read that.
Yeah.
Power and strength.
Yeah.
And Psalm 33, the Lord is my shepherd. I was that lost sheep.
Good for you.
But it means so much to me, the groups here.
Yeah.
And everyone in New Frontiers. My hand. I went to Benny Hinn when he was at Norwich Stadium.
Yeah.
I got on the stage. I was homeless. He prayed for me. Then they had the Voice of America, the God Channel, satellite in it. I never saw it. I was on the stadium, and he prayed for me and my friend. My friend that was on stage with me at Norwich Stadium when he was there is now dead. Yeah.
Mm.
But I still burn the candle for that person.
Yeah.
It means so much. And God is so strong.
Bless you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
We could stop there, really, couldn't we? I do, yeah. And actually, Andrew's going to talk a bit about that in his section, yeah. So just the last thing I wanted to talk about, really, was this personality disorder heading, which is often characterised by emotional instability, maybe impulsive behaviours often, which can be self-defeating in their nature, sometimes self-harming and suicidal attempts and that kind of thing. And often these people can be the best people to work with and also the hardest people to work with as well, that they can produce their challenges. If any of us are in ministries to do with prisons or homeless people or anything like that, chances are we're coming into contact with high numbers of people with these kind of behaviours and maybe diagnosed or not, but these kind of difficulties. And so this is the last kind of section, if you like, under the personality disorder. And really what I just wanted to leave you with was the idea of us being advocates, which is a very much a nursing kind of thing, which I live with, but I wanted to share with you in terms of really speaking up for people with mental health problems, that when we go to our GP or our doctors, it can be one of the most nerve-wracking things that we do if we're concerned about our health. and all the more for someone with someone with mental health problems. It can be a very nerve-wracking thing, particularly going to see a psychiatrist when you know that they have the power to lock you up in hospital. Then that's a very difficult thing to do, and we can play a major role in supporting people we know in those appointments, even in going along, helping someone prepare to say what they're going to prepare what they're going to say and questions they might ask. And that's something that any of us can do. And it's all about supporting that person and encouraging them to maybe overcome something that they find very difficult in their lives. So that's the last bit, and I'll hand you over to Andrew, and he'll continue. The question was, do they still administer electric shock or electric convulsive therapy? And they do in extreme cases, they still do. Yeah, and a lot of people have in the past, but these days it's actually used a lot more sparingly, thankfully. But that's probably another lecture. I'll pass over to Andrew.
So I'm Andrew. My background is, for 5.5 years, I was a mental health social worker working in an inner city community mental health team. I had the wonderful upbringing. My early years was I actually grew up in the grounds of a psychiatric hospital, which was great fun because my father was a psychiatric nurse and we used to live in the grounds, and I used to get to meet some of my dad's patients, and so I feel like it's in my blood a little bit. So if I go a little bit crazy, you know why. Okay. What my brief is really, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about community mental health teams. The reason is, in churches and projects, the team that we're most likely to come into contact with is the community mental health team. So I want to explain a little bit about what that team is, what it looks like, what they do, the different professionals, and how we can access support through from the mental health teams. I then also want to give, you know, time to look at what the local church, what we and the projects that we run have to offer to people with mental health difficulties. I'm also want to touch on the issue of whether we can attribute demonic influences to the symptoms of mental health disorders. This is a controversial, contentious issue. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'm sure there may be questions that will come up at the end. So just so you know, that's going to be coming up. Right, what is a community mental health team? Community mental health team is a NHS stroke local government team. They're usually combined. It's a multidisciplinary team of professionals who work together. And we've got psychiatrists. We've got a list coming up. There's psychiatrists. We've got psychologists. We've got community psychiatric nurses, which is Ian. You have occupational therapists. You have mental health social workers. And you have ASWs, which I'll come on to. Don't look too closely at your notes because I want to unpack what an ASW might be in a little while. Psychiatrists. Who are psychiatrists? They are doctors. They are not somebody that you sit on a couch with and have a long discussion about your past and your you open your soul to them. They are doctors who are interested in the disorder or potential disorder, diagnosing and treating. And it's very medical-based, it's medication-based. Yes, they take into consideration your culture, subculture, as Ian was saying, but they are focused on disorder and medication. And sometimes people find them very cold and I can't talk to my psychiatrist, but that's very much because that's their background. Some are very good, obviously, and are very approachable. Some are not. And so you can't guarantee. Within a team, you sparingly will have psychologists who administer the talking therapies. Has anybody heard of CBT? Does anybody know what CBT is? That's right. And what's that? It's talking. what it is, cognitive is your thoughts, behaviour, your actions. It's looking at how the interaction between your thoughts and your thinking processes and your actions and how your actions affect your thoughts and breaking the cycles. I mean, that's what it's about, simplistically. Okay? Generally, within community mental health teams, that's the main therapy that you'd get. You wouldn't be getting what we call psychotherapy, which is the long, drawn-out talking and spending years looking through your history and patterns of abuse, simply because that takes years. And what the NHS is interested in is quick results. And they want you to be seen 6 to 12 sessions and to come out a changed person. Okay, that's my cynical. I think it is very effective and I think it can be very useful. And even biblically, we can say, well, there's about transforming the mind. You know, there are patterns that you can say, okay, well, that fits with, we can kind of understand. But just so you know, there are limitations. There's a huge shortage of psychologists in the country and mental health teams. The mental health team I had 1.5 psychologists who were covering a population of between 50 and 100,000. Okay? So you aren't going to get and see one very quickly. It's usually 6 months to a year waiting list. Okay? The government says that there should be more psychologists, but they don't put the money up to then provide them often. You then would have CPNs, community psychiatric nurses. Generally, you've got the clinicians within a mental health team, the CPNs, mental health workers, OTs, who carry a caseload. This varies around the country, but it can be between 30 and 50 cases. And this is to work within a limited 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, dealing with 30 to 50 cases, just to paint a picture of the limitations, actually, that community mental teams have. Sometimes as Christians, we have a lot of expectations from them. And what I'm coming on to is I believe the church has more to offer in some ways. We can draw on the expertise. But in terms of the day-to-day, practical, loving, there's a limit. And just so you're aware of the pressures that they are under. CPNs would administer medication. They will assess new patients. And they'll give general and specific support within the community. You then have this group called OTs. They're not always in mental health teams, but sometimes they are. They do much the same as the CPN, but they don't tend to administer medication. They carry a caseload, and they're pretty good at this idea of OT intervention, occupational therapist intervention, which I'm not going to go into detail on, but yes. Good question. The question is, we have to repeat the question for the tape. The question is, if exercise is seen as such a good benefit to mental health, why do we not have physios and things employed? Good question. Probably worth petitioning your MP about it or the mental health teams. I have heard recently of there being some teams that are doing it. There are some teams that are beginning to do that type of thing. Right. Right. Right.
And that was not always the case. It was quite a reasonably big team of physios that were employed, I would say, about 5 years ago.
Yes.
And I just don't understand this. And I mean, I speak from personal experience. That I know how good the OT's role is. Mm.
Yes, I agree. I think as a church project, we have to come aware of the fact that these are the limitations. I don't know if people have ever heard of exercise on prescription. This is something that is recognised as an option. A lot of GPs don't actually know about it.
It's limited. It's only for a 3-mile area.
Right, so there are limitations.
Without prescription, you couldn't support the gym membership. What's going to change at the end of the 3 months? Having reacted positively to exercise, you're then left out on a limb.
Yes.
So and it's on the air, I think art is ongoing.
Right, I think it must depend, because there wasn't a limitation. I'm also working with some guy at the moment who actually, there's a new thing in Birmingham where if you get a passport for leisure, you actually can start using gyms for free, the council gyms. Right.
8 to 9 in the morning, what
right. Having been there, I can agree with you on that one.
Things that don't cost anything that involve exercise.
Yes, yes. So the point is that there's lots of things that can be done that don't have to cost money. And this is something to keep in our minds, I guess, as we're working with these people, that, you know, if we can get them out playing sport, involved in the things, then go for it. Yes?
Is it also mean environmentally, it's about self-esteem? It's actually feeling that you're accepted back in the community. I share with Richard, we've had a breakdown many years ago. And a lot of things you were saying really pinned into my life. It's through God, it was actually also somebody, not necessarily in the church that started, but the Lord brought me to a place where somebody actually started to give me my self-esteem back and give me the respect, which unfortunately mental health, still within the media, still within the government, is seen as, mental health, you know, stay away from it. And all we're doing is looking at symptoms rather than actually looking at the root problems and looking at why are people homeless. Well, people have put themselves homeless because they see nowhere else in life to go but to be homeless. That's the only place they feel safe. They've lost all sense of their self-esteem, and that's it. It's actually the churches now actually supporting people, the homeless, to kind of into the communities and get some of their self-esteem back. And really, when you think about it, it should be the governments that should be looking at that, and they should be creating more areas for that to happen.
In some senses, I agree with you that the government can be doing more. The government, I believe, is restricted. I believe the church isn't and doesn't have to be restricted. So I hear what you're saying, that the government could be doing more on some of these things, and you're right. However, they are restricted. There's so many restrictions coming in.
Well, the good thing for me, myself, still actually working at the health now.
Right. Great.
And that in itself, in my own work, is fantastic. Because
yes.
It shows how you can go full circle.
Yeah.
To find that your experiences and the way you are, you find you understand people at a much more level than you would do if you're just a professional.
Yes. Great. So do you hear my point in terms of what I believe the church has?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's for us to carry, and that's the baton for us to carry, and the really that torch in terms of what we can offer. Yes. Cool. I'll move on because I've got a few things I want to get to. So thank you for your questions. I'm going to move on to mental health social workers. This is something I know a lot about, but I won't go into too much detail. They would carry a similar caseload. They're generally not medication-based. My friend here often says that mental health social workers love to say we don't administer medication, and for some reason we make a big point of it as if it matters. But we're really interested in the social context of that individual. We're interested in, social workers are trained to look at their family, their culture, their religion, their ethnicity, every aspect of their social context, and to work with them within that context. Whether that actually happens or not often is down to pressures and targets, etc. But that tends to be where social workers are coming from. There are this weird group called ASWs, and I don't want you to look at your notes for a second. What would you say, what is an ASW? You're going to look at your notes now, aren't you? ASWs are these strange social workers called approved social workers. Now, what does that mean? Are they approved? I never was a social worker. Does that mean I wasn't approved to be a social worker? No. What it means is that they have a specific approve. They're approved by the Mental Health Act 1983, which is the one we're still currently under, to perform specific aspects of that act. Has anybody heard the term being sectioned? Yes. Sometimes I feel I was close.
And also an ASW is a support worker as well.
An ASW will carry a caseload. An ASW is in essence the same as a mental health social worker, but they have this approved tag on them.
So I see a support worker through the trust.
Right.
They come to me once a month and make sure that I haven't self-harmed myself or I've got any problems with money or whatever. Yeah.
Yes.
Or anything like this. Yeah, but they do understand.
So they're very much the support net, yeah. But, so they do provide the same role as a CPA and a social worker. However, they do have this thing about being sectioned. What's that about? What's being sectioned?
Section of the Act.
It is all about a section, specific sections of the Act. It's a strange term that we've come to use it. And mental health social workers wouldn't tend to use it. We would talk about assessing people under the Mental Health Act, rather than sectioning somebody. Briefly, the two main ones of interest would be section 2, which means that somebody can be detained in hospital against their will for a process of assessment for up to 28 days. This is if there's a belief that this person is going to harm themselves or so significant harm to others, and if they don't want to go involuntary. There is the option then that a psychiatrist has, which has to include a psychiatrist, preferably the person's GP, but often not, so it would be another psychiatrist, and an approved social worker. They would assess the person and would, at that point, this is the current practice. The current practice would be that they would then assess the person and decide if they met the criteria to be detained against their will. This is a massive infringement of somebody's human rights. Okay? So this isn't something that we take lightly. And obviously people have the right to appeal because suddenly there's these three professionals who are like a court of law almost imprisoning somebody. So this is big stuff. And when we're asking for mental health act assessments, we need to be aware of that. There's also section 3, which is for treatment. So if they're going to be sectioned under section 3, they would have to be diagnosed with a mental disorder. And they can be detained in hospital for treatment for up to 6 months initially. It can then be reviewed after another 6 months, and it then can be reviewed annually. So you do get some people who are detained under Section 3 for a number of years. My experience isn't that common. Generally, it would be briefer. But nowadays, it's not that common. That's because there's such a massive shortage of beds. Generally, the doctors are trying to get them out as quickly as they can. Okay.
What was Section 63? Or was that
Section? That was the previous Mental Health Act. Yeah. So this is the Health Act 83. And there's going to be a revision. There's going to be a new one coming out in the near future.
Some of them have it's against their will. Can they still refuse treatment?
No, they actually can be enforced treatment, and that could be in the force of injection. If somebody actually puts up a fight, they can be pinned down, restrained, thank you. Social worker speak, pinned down. Nurse speak, restrained. That they can be restrained and then be administered the medication. And that is, they have the doctors and the nurses have the power to do that. There are many other sections and roles of ASWs, but we don't have time to go into that now. But they're the ones to be aware of. Okay, I want to spend some time looking at... How are we doing for time? Okay. I'm going to spend some time now looking at the local church, which is us, and any projects that we may therefore run or any projects that we might be interested in running. Galatians 6:2. Calls us to bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Romans 12:15 says, we're told to mourn with those who mourn. As Ian and I were discussing this seminar, we both agreed that in our 10 plus years of combined professional work with people with mental health difficulties, severe and mild, the stark reality is that for the majority of these people, the stark reality is their utter loneliness. They can be misunderstood, stigmatized, rejected by family and friends, and at times society, or quite often depending on what the disorder is. As I was thinking about this, you know, there's one that immediately comes to mind that experienced all of these things, which was Jesus. Okay, Jesus was misunderstood, stigmatized, rejected. Okay. And his spirit is on the earth, and we are his body, and we are filled with his spirit. Okay? God doesn't want people to carry their depression alone. God doesn't want people to experience delusions and hallucinations as if they were real, alone. God doesn't want people to go through times of elated mood, overspending, damaging friendships and relationships, losing their employment, and then hit by the crushing low of depression to the point where I've sometimes seen people virtually catatonic, unable to speak, unable to do anything, alone. God doesn't want people to feel that the only option available is suicide, alone. God doesn't want people to feel that they have to cut and burn themselves as the only way that they know to feel something, or more often to feel something other than the internal pain, alone. Okay? I believe that the most important thing that the church has to offer is the unconditional love of Jesus Christ and the healing power of a loving, caring community. To love and befriend, to get alongside, to listen to the crazy stuff and not get shocked and not get freaked out. It's with this in mind that when Ian and I were thinking about practical ways that we could offer you to go away from this seminar, that we were reminded of, and are reminded of, there are befriending services in the community that offer services to people with mental health. Our experience is that they are vastly under-resourced, they don't have enough volunteers, and that although they have a great service to offer, the reality is there just isn't the manpower there. What a great opportunity for the church. If you don't have a ministry at all to people with mental health, this is, you know, what better way than ringing up your local mental health team and saying, do you have befriending services that I might be able to find out about? And that you can just start meeting people in their homes or in a coffee, you know, a coffee place, and just being a friend. If there's a group of you and you feel you want to start a ministry, you know, how about going to your local mental health team and saying, we're really interested in setting up a befriending service. Now, the mental health team may well want to be sure that you're not going to be, you know, putting things on people, putting on your own beliefs, putting on, you know, it being an overtly evangelical thing. But Jesus calls us to serve. And so in terms of opportunity to build relationship with, get to know what the reality is for these guys, what life is like, how about getting in and spending some time with them? Because it's then that it gets rid of the stigma and it gets rid of the perceptions that we have and the misunderstandings that we have. You spend some quality time with people going through mental distress. And I won't carry on. I'll start getting emotional otherwise. Please do.
With 1 in 4 people experiencing depression over a period of a year, and with the likelihood that 1 in 4 people are experiencing that within each church, what is available as a way to communicate, not just to people who are looking to head up or to work more one-on-one with people, but to educate our churches in how you respond to people with a disability that you can't see? I think often the fear comes because people don't know how to interpret another individual.
Yes.
And that's often the fear of the homeless, and that's often the fear of people with mental health issues. How do we create the kind of environment within the church where people just feel accepted and where people do not see mental health as subnormal?
Yeah.
Answer how not to do it. Don't judge them.
Yes.
Don't make them feel as if they're weak or not a proper Christian if they suffer from depression. It's so hard to feel judged. You know, as if you are alone even within a church and that nobody understands you. And I think the greatest help my pastor was with me, I suffered from depression. I told him I'd gone back on the antidepressants. And he said, I can't do anything. I don't understand. I've never experienced it. I can, use me. I can empathise with these people as well as sympathise with them.
Yeah.
Because I've been there. I think God can use mental illness to help you help others.
Yes.
I think the church has got to accept that.
Yes. In summary.
A few people I'm on antidepressants because they make me feel shame.
Yes. Yes. In summary, the question is how can the church be better equipped to deal with people with mental illness in an unstigmatizing and unjudgmental way? Yeah. Is the essence of what you're both saying. A, spending time with the guys. If we understand scripture, we understand Jesus and his teachings, is that we are never to judge. That's not our role, that's God's role. That we come and that we love and we serve in the way that Jesus did. There isn't any other way. I mean, I speak as a mental health professional, but first and foremost as a son of God. There is no other way, really. Yes, you can get people in to do some training. Yes, you can link in with your mental health professionals to ask them maybe to come and do a talk. Yes, you can, as you build relationship with people who have mental difficulties, ask them to come and talk about their experiences. It's really about getting in there, getting known at all times, not being judgmental. My own experience is I've had two significant episodes of depression myself in the past 3 years and have gone from being a mental health professional, a leader in the church, who has then experienced the crushing reality of not being able to function. And talking to my family, my friends and my church community about being on antidepressants and going through the healing process that I've had to go through has been so significant for me in terms of understanding Jesus' heart for people who have mental health difficulties. And in every church, there will be people who are having those experiences, but often they won't want to let people know because they're scared of what people will say. Because if you're Christian, you really shouldn't be feeling that bad.
Yeah, but you also think part of the church's responsibility in counseling, and this is something I really think is very important, that if there's a counseling church for a specific need, then they should really be trained in that specific area to help that person. Or if somebody is counseling, that they have the vision and the wisdom to say, look, you need to go and see somebody in this area, because doctors yes. are not there for bad, psychiatrists are not there for bad, and sure. people also have that problem. I think if the church does that, then you can work along with the mental health teams in NHS where they might actually even come into church. That way they yes. will be saying, we're more the head now because they're coming to us.
Yes.
Rather than us keep on going to them for them, they'll actually come to us because we are doing something they're not necessarily doing.
In essence, the better relationship we have with the mental health services, yeah. the better they're going to see us because they can see us as a bit wacky, particularly if we are casting demons out of people who hear voices and telling people to stop taking medication. They're going to see us as wacky because our experience as mental health professionals, that isn't helpful. The word of God is so much more about us offering love and serving, and interlinking with the professionals will always help in terms of understanding the church and the church understanding the mental health services. Yes. Sorry, can you speak up a little bit louder? It's okay. So the dilemma is that if you start building relationship with them, they then might start getting worried about your involvement. Is that right?
The dilemma is that
sorry.
You start building relationships with the community mental health team.
Yes.
Then the person with mental health might feel that you're
on
their side.
Okay, I'm with you now. Right. Great. Yes. Okay. So we're working with people who have mental health difficulties. If we then start communicating with their mental health teams, the person with the mental health difficulty is going to feel that you're suddenly siding with the others.
Yeah.
That's the essence of... Okay. Yeah, do you want to...
I think often it's on a one-to-one basis, so this isn't necessarily the church, relating to a whole team, but often it's on a one-to-one basis as well. So there might be particularly someone that you're supporting with mental health difficulties, and so you might have then a relationship with the CPN involved or the worker who's attached to that person, and so therefore it's much more on a kind of personal level, that relationship. Now, depending on the person's condition, they might feel paranoid about that, and they might be concerned that you are not necessarily working in their interests if they're concerned about the team who they're working with and relating to. But I'd have thought generally for people, even if they're feeling paranoid for whatever reason, if you are showing them unconditional love, then that shows through, and actually people can see your genuine intent in that. And even if you're having discussions with their CPN, their social worker, that people don't necessarily see that if you've built up that relationship. And I suppose what we're trying to get across is it is about building up those relationships. It is about discipleship. It is about supporting somebody with mental health problems. And
sorry, I'm still missing a little bit. Right.
I agree that there can be times where we're not siding with people that other people view as oppressive, or they're the people that section me, they're the people that locked me away. However, my experience with my patients that I've worked with is that they haven't generally had that view of me or the services, and actually they've tended to see me as a support. And I guess you've got to take it as an individual basis on whoever you're working with, that if you feel that they have that idea of feeling threatened and almost paranoid about the mental health services, that, you know, that you've got to take it within their context and their particular situation.
But you would always empower them anyway and ask for their permission to contact, I would have thought, the mental health professionals they're working with. So it's not going around their
yes.
back. It's actually saying, would this be of use to you? Do you
yes.
give me permission to? So that they are in charge. The moment you take away anybody's right to be in charge of their own mental health support,
yes,
is the moment you're skipping the sectioning and kind of but doing it for them. So,
yeah.
you
yeah.
know, I think if you're going to be giving them the right to say yes or no to it, then the likelihood that they're going to misinterpret it is going to be...
Yeah, and that's absolutely crucial in terms of any work that we do with people with mental health difficulties. We make sure that they're happy with any dialogue or any conversation that we have with anyone, really. One quick question.
Do you want to just finish?
Yeah, shall I finish?
That stuff there,
yeah.
Is that all right? And then we'll just...
Because we'll be overrunning a little bit. Very quickly, in terms of mental health difficulties, people with mental health difficulties coming into the church, just like anybody else, need discipleship. And in terms of getting alongside, loving, caring, as part of discipleship, I suggest a good biblical teaching on emotions is essential, i.e. that our emotions are God-given and serve a purpose, and that we need to understand our emotions, express them to God, and deal with them, I believe always benefits somebody with mental health difficulties, whether it's the neurosis or the psychosis. My experience of working with patients is that beginning to unravel their mixture of emotions is always helpful. And I believe as a church, we have a good thing to offer with that. And I encourage you all to begin to look at how you can develop that in your own lives and within your discipleship processes. Okay, I want to spend a couple of minutes looking at demonization of mental health. Within the Christian world, I've said already, this is contentious and a controversial issue. And we come to you with our considered thoughts as both mental health professionals and as spirit-filled Christians. In the vast majority of people suffering with severe mental illness, this tends to be the mood disorders, severe mood disorders, schizophrenia, psychosis, hearing voices, etc. We do not believe that their hallucinations, their voices, and their delusions, their beliefs, are caused by demonic influence. On the huge majority, our experience is that. Many people can live normally with adequate support and treatment with these illnesses. And actually, we work with people in the community and they live a normal life, some of them, and can do. There are some people that even the professionals would say they don't quite fit into any of the clear diagnosable disorders. And as Christians, we may then, through discernment of the Holy Spirit, come to believe that there are demonic influences. At this point, if somebody is willing, we could well go with them to the leadership and follow recognized and established ways of rooting out and dealing with the demonic. I'm not going to go into too much more detail. This isn't the purpose of the session today. I would recommend books by Dave Devenish, particularly in terms of his book, Demolishing Strongholds, for a comprehensive theology and methodology of healing, handling the demonic. Okay? And urge, you know, and suggest that that's a good route to take. I believe it becomes dangerous if we start thinking that because people are hearing voices, even if they're demonic in content, they might talk about there being demons that are afflicting them. Coming from a mental health professional perspective, if somebody's got some kind of religious background or some kind of, you know, it could be any kind of religious background that they've grown up with, when somebody becomes ill and have a psychosis, they often will latch onto their experiences and their elements of their belief, but then become distorted. So just because somebody is talking about things like that doesn't necessarily mean that there is something demonic going on. I'd also want to remind you that in the New Testament, demons cause epilepsy, deafness, blindness, muteness, and suicidal feelings. And would anyone want to diagnose demons in all modern cases of these problems? In the New Testament, demons often spoke or seemed to speak in rational dialogue. Untreated people with psychosis and schizophrenia speak irrationally. Okay, there's a difference. And you can ask any questions on the end on those issues. Just to finish with, I've got a quote from Stephen Waterhouse, who says, "People suffering with mental illness and their families comprise a huge, overlooked target group for evangelism. And helping them also brings interaction and ministry with unsaved leaders in many diverse professions, the mental health teams, etc. Evangelicals lose opportunities from failing to address this need through awkwardness and ignorance and withdrawal. In reality, there is a wide open door for potential ministry, as I feel we've already outlined." Okay. That's the end of our presentation. We're supposed to finish at 1, are we? I suggest if you want to go and grab lunch, please do. We'll finish officially there. Otherwise, if you want to stay and ask a couple more questions, please do. So we'll... Oh, just to say, on our... I'll do... we've given our email addresses. ian.walker@bsmht.nhs.uk, andrew@thebridge.uk.net. Please feel free to contact us with any questions. We'll do our best to get back to you on things. There are work email addresses, so don't feel you're intruding.